The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our author event series, recorded live at the Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, the Central Library Expansion Project, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
I'm Mary Flournoy, and I recently retired from the Free Library of Philadelphia after 38 and a half years. For the last 5 years, I was a member of the One Book, One Philadelphia Committee. I'm proud to say that every one of our 54 branches in the Free Library is holding programs for One Book, One Philadelphia. One Book, One Philadelphia is more than just a program of the Free Library or of the mayor's office of the city. It's a regional program. We have hundreds of community partners in the region that are holding programs, distributing materials, and helping to spread the word about One Book. I hope that all of you had a chance to pick up the calendar. This lists an amazing number of programs, from book discussions of our three featured book, especially What is the What, our One Book selection for the year, programs for children featuring African folk tales and crafts, films, even special discount days at some of our Ethiopian and African restaurants in the city. And also, please be sure to take a copy of the resource guide. This gives you a lot of background information on what's happening and what has happened in Sudan and Ethiopia, as well as background information on our three books and additional resources, such as films, that will help you understand what's happening. This is the sixth year of One Book, and for the last 3 years, we've included companion books, books for children, teens, and adult education students who might not be able to read the featured book. While other cities have a One Book program, I think Philadelphia is the only city that now tries to include books for other ages. I think this makes our program richer and extends the message of the books to other audiences, and families can learn and read together. The book for children is Brothers in Hope, which is based on the real-life stories of some of the lost boys of Sudan. Now, I'm wearing two hats tonight. First, as a former librarian, especially a teen librarian, I'm also the current president of the board of Community Learning Center, which is an adult literacy program in Kensington. And because of my interest in getting books for teens and for adult education students, I kept bugging Jerry Truskin, who's our One Book project coordinator, about finding out what the teen book was. And when she first showed me the title of Beatles and Angels, I remember looking over her shoulder, and then I got to look through it. I was so excited. It has a great cover. It has photographs inside and even recipes. And it looked very, very readable and accessible to a lot of readers. But when I read of Beatles and Angels, I was even more impressed. It is the story of Mawi Askadum's remarkable journey from Ethiopia, where he was born, to a refugee camp in Sudan, to growing up in Wheaton, Illinois, to Harvard University, where he was chosen to deliver the commencement speech. Since he graduated in 1999, Mawi has spoken to more than 500,000 people across the United States, many of them teens. Actually, the book says 100,000, but today I went onto his website and it said 500,000. So we're very honored to have him with us tonight. Mawi has written three other books for teenagers. Of Beatles and Angels has been read by entire grades, the entire eighth grade in St. Paul, Minnesota. 3,000 eighth graders read and discussed the book. And the city of Green Bay, Wisconsin, chose it as their One Book selection. Now, I mentioned Community Learning Center, and some of the adult GED students there have read the book and wrote their reactions to A Beatles and Angels. I'd like to share one of those responses with you. The chapter I liked most was The Unmaking of a Man, because it reminded me of when I used to be embarrassed when my mother would sing to people. I would lie and say she wasn't my mother. In the same way as Maui, I never knew that my mother was a very interesting person who had a kind heart. It wasn't until a short time ago that people told me my mother helped a lot of neighborhood kids by providing them food and a place to stay. At Harvard, the commencement speech coach said, "Maui Askadom gave one of the most successful speeches that I have heard in the 21 years I've been coaching the speakers. He is witty and personable, the kind of speaker one likes the moment he begins to talk, and is able in simple and elegant language to convey profound truth with brevity and sincerity. After he speaks, you'll have a chance to ask him some questions, and then afterwards, you may go upstairs to have some books signed by him. At this point, I'd like you to join me in welcoming our featured speaker, Maui Askadom."
My brothers and my sisters, it's a good day to be here with you today. You know, when I speak to the audiences sometimes, they say to me, "Brother Maui, you come from Africa. Do you not have an accent for us today?" So I'm faking this accent for you for the first 30 seconds in case somebody here wanted an accent. I do that sometimes. I did it for the students earlier today, and they liked it, so I figured I'd do it for you. But I've been in the States for 23 years now, and this is how I talk. And that wasn't even an East African accent, for those of you who know accent. That was a very busted West African, maybe Nigerian accent, if that. So I'm happy to be here with you. You know, let me start by sharing a story with you where when I was an undergraduate student, I was a history major. And you know, one of the most interesting things I learned as a history major was that if there's no books written about your people, that means that you don't matter. So books are only written about people that matter. And so, for example, in this country, if you went to a bookstore in 1950, you know, if, let's say you were a little girl, you'd go in there and all the biographies would be about men. And what would that tell you if you were a little girl? That would tell you that, hey, men do all the important things in this world. Only men, you know, can rise to the level of having biographies written about them. And one of the reasons I wrote my book, A Beatles and Angels, was I wanted to say, hey, refugees are important. You know, there hasn't been a book written about black refugees. How come? You know, our stories are important too. We deserve to have people read about us, study about us. And so to have your city select A Beatles and Angels as a companion book, and also just to select the theme of refugees, I mean, you're implicitly, what you're saying is, hey, refugees do matter. It's important for us to understand and learn about people from different backgrounds, what they go through, and to try to connect and learn. And as such, I am proud to be here and to be a part of that with you. And I want to thank you for inviting me to share my story through my book, through my speech. It's a big honor for me. And so I just want to start by thanking the city of Philadelphia, the library, and all of you who are here today for your interest in affirming the value of refugees, of people who come from different backgrounds and seeking out that knowledge. So thank you very much. Just want to say that first. And I want you to recognize, I want you to recognize that the books that we select to study, the kind of art we select to lift up, these all say a lot about what we value and what we think are important, what things are important or not important. So it's not these kind of decisions when people are sitting around deciding what things should be looked at and stuff like that. They shouldn't be taken lightly. People are revealing a lot about what the kind of underpinnings of what is or isn't important when they make decisions like that. So I'm excited to be here. What I would like to do in this presentation is I would like to share a little bit of my story. I'll start by telling you a couple stories that weren't in my book. So I'll give you a little bonus. That's one of the reasons why it's good to have the author here. They can tell you things that, if you like the book, well, did you know this and this also happened? So I'll do that with some of my family's time in Ethiopia. Then I will share with you a couple of just things that stand out to me. We could talk for hours, but I just selected a few things that really have meant a lot to me in my journey that I would like to share with all of you. Some of them are lessons from my book. And then after that, we'll do a Q&A. I love it. The presentations are much more fun when they're audience-driven, so when they're interactive, and also when the audience has a chance to ask questions. So we're going to save a lot of time for Q&A. And you also see that during my presentation, we're going to do probably at least two activities. I'm crazy about doing activities with audiences. Sometimes I'll do like 8 activities in an hour. You don't think it can be done, but it's more fun for everybody because you don't have to sit there the whole time and just listen to me. You can be a part of the learning, and we can do it together. So let me just jump right into it then and start by telling you a few stories about just my family's experiences, what it was like coming to the States, all the things we went through, and we'll go from there. So all of you know that I was born in East Africa, in the country of Ethiopia. I'm half Ethiopian, half Eritrean. So my father's from Eritrea, my mother's from Ethiopia. And those of you who know Eritrean-Ethiopian history know that that means something. That it's not like saying, hey, I'm, you know, my mom's from Washington State and my dad's from Oregon or something like that. You know, that means something in certain parts of the world. Now, I was born in a small village called Adwala in the northern part of Ethiopia. I lived there with my father, Halab, my mother, Tsige, my brother, Twelde, and my sister, Jennifer. We were all living there together. I always throw that out there in my speech, just because I'm wondering if the audience is paying attention or if they've already gone into autopilot, you know, where it's time to just listen to what the speaker says and we're going to go through this thing. So you've seen Sesame Street. Which one of these is not like the other? Obviously, my father, Halab, mother, Tsige, brother, Twelde, sister, Jennifer. It's not Jennifer. It's Mehret, is my sister's name. And we live in Adwala. And I would, one of the things I think that Americans assume is that, which is often a good assumption, but I guess the point I'm trying to make is I would still be over there, and if there hadn't been a war, that's probably where my mom would have preferred to stay. Like, she would, even though there's a lot more opportunities here, that's where her relatives were, that's where the way of life was, that's the reason my family fled was there was a war. That was the genesis of it. It wasn't that we said, hey, let's find this country called America. It was that, you know, there was a war. It was a very hard decision because when you leave, that means you're saying goodbye to your mom, your uncles, your cousins, the country you know, maybe the language, a lot of things. And what happened in my homeland, as you know, is there was a war that started in 1961 and didn't end till 1991. So it lasted about 30 years, and that'd be like a war starting here today in 2008 in Philadelphia, in this area, and not ending till 2038. So sometimes we hear stories about, oh, there's been a war going on for 10 years there or 15 years there. It's not until we put ourselves in that situation and say, hey, what would it be like if in my town, the one I'm living in right now, there was a war from today and it didn't end till, so if someone here is 30, you'd be 60 when it ended. If someone here is 25, you would be 55 when it ended. And so there's entire generations where literally that was, you know, the main driver of their experience was this war. And one of the things that happened, as you saw in my book, was that a lot of times families got separated for different reasons. So in my family situation, what happened was my father, he was a village doctor, and so there were 4 or 5 different rebel groups that lived right near us. We were right on the border between Eritrea and Ethiopia, and they all wanted my father to help only their soldiers. And in fact, what they really wanted him to do was go live with them in the wilderness or go wherever they went and stay with them. And so if my father tried to flee with his family, are they going to let him leave? No, that's like, it would be, you know, would you let your hospital leave Philadelphia? You wouldn't. You wanted to stay here. And he was, if my father couldn't help you in our village, nobody could help you. He wasn't a trained doctor, but he birthed, you know, he delivered the babies. He treated snake bite. He stitched people up. that that trial and error, that's how he learned. And so the way he escaped was he went to Sudan. He told all the people there, yeah, I'm going to be back. I'm just getting some supplies. But he told my mom the secret. I'm not coming back. You're going to have to make your own way because this thing's getting too crazy. We got to find a way to get out of here. And so my father went to Sudan. We didn't know if we'd ever see him again. We didn't know if he was alive or dead. There's no way to communicate once he left, really. Maybe some people who went back and forth might tell you, but not too much communication. And then that put a lot of pressure on my mom, because now my mother, you know, she was 15 when she married my dad, and he was about 35. So when she had three kids, and she was only 21 years old, and so now as a 21-year-old, she has to make this journey across the wilderness with the three kids under the age of 5 to a place she's never been before. Hyenas travel in pack. They're pack animals, so they can, you know, if they're traveling in packs of 100, 150, they can kill lions, let alone humans. One of the stories my mom actually tells is how one of her friends was eaten by a hyena, and she tells some story. And I still, I don't remember that many things, but I still remember light bulb-like eyes lighting up from the hyenas. And two stories I'll tell you real quick, though, that aren't in the book are, one, my mother became so nervous going across the wilderness that she couldn't eat anymore. Because she couldn't eat anymore, she wasn't able to produce breast milk. And my little sister didn't have her teeth, so she wasn't able to chew the food that we had. So what my mother did going across the wilderness was she would chew the food in her own mouth, then she spit it in her hand, and she put it in my sister's mouth. And that's how she saved my sister's life, basically, going across the wilderness. How many of y'all would do the same thing if you were in that same situation? That was the only way. Raise your hand if you do the same thing. And that was one of the things that even struck me when I was reading. So I had some responses from some of the adult literacy students about their responses to my book. And as I was reading through the responses, one of the things that struck me was that, you know, they responded to a lot of things that were in my book kind of how I would respond to them. And it kind of reminded me that maybe we're not as different as we think we are. So you probably, when you come to a presentation like this, you're hearing a presentation, for most of you, I would guess, you're hearing about someone whose experience is different than yours, but all of you just said you would do the same exact thing if you were in that wilderness. So one of the things to get from, you know, learning about each other and studying each other, in my opinion, is that as we put ourselves in each other's shoes, we come to learn that maybe we're not as different. If we were put in that situation, maybe we would do similar things that we have not done in our lives. And someone who comes from a different country, you know, what are all the things that do bring us together? What are all the things that are similar about us? Are some of the things that I ask. And so, another story. This is actually a crazy story, and I talked to the students about it today, but I didn't tell them the full story. I'll tell you the full story. This is the story that I still can't believe. So, once we got to Sudan, to the border. By the way, this is a journey that not just my family made, but hundreds of thousands of people made across the wilderness. You know, my story is not, the only thing that really makes my story different and is more coming to the States, going to Harvard, giving a commencement speech, writing the books, that kind of stuff. But in terms of being a refugee, coming over here, and that experience, millions of people have done that. And some people died, some people made it. My family was lucky enough to survive and make it. The story that I think is the craziest, though, that I still have trouble understanding sometimes, is, so there were, like I told you before, there were different rebel groups. And so they're fighting each other and the Ethiopian army. So you have to not just beat the Ethiopian army, you also have to beat the other rebel groups. Now, they're all fighting control for the region. Now, there were some folks there who used to eat at our house who knew my family well, who knew my dad, who knew my mom. And we got to the border, and some of them were there. And these were our friends. And what they told my mother was, hey, we're staying here to fight for our country. If you think you can go to another country, not going to happen. You got to stay right here. So my mother argued with them and argued with them and argued with them. And finally they said, you know what? We're going to take your five-year-old son. We're going to take Twelde. The rest of you can go. We're going to take your five. And someday he's going to join our armies, but we're going to take him. And the thing that I find crazy about the story is that these were our friends before. And there's been times in my experience where you see some things about human beings or some things that really make you question our basic goodness. And there's going to be other times where you see things and you get really excited and you say, yes, we as human beings are great. You know, we're just inherently good. But we had a sickness called tiktika, where whatever you eat, you throw up. Whatever you drink, you throw up. We were dying. My siblings and I were dying, and they wouldn't let us pass. And my mother argued and fought with them for weeks, for over 2 weeks. And finally, one of them said, are you guys crazy? Just let them go. What's wrong with you? And we couldn't do anything about it. They had guns. We didn't have anything. And they decided to let us go. And that's, I think, a lot of the experience of being a refugee is that there's a lot of random things like that. They wanted to, they could take you to the wilderness. If not, they can let you go. It's a lot of it is random. Some people come to the States, some people don't come to the States. And those people who do survive or who have opportunities aren't any better than those who don't. A lot of it is luck, chance, and yeah, I'll just leave it at that. But we got through. I didn't put that story in my book, partly because my mother was too scared to put that story in that book. She just didn't want me to put that. So there's lots of stories like that I knew. So imagine if you were writing a story about your life, how many of you would not put certain things in the book? Like everybody in this room would for sure leave out a whole bunch of stuff, and it would probably be the best stuff too, right? But you're not allowed to tell those stories, because if you do, someone's going to be calling you up and breathing down your neck, and you might lose some friends, and it could be really ugly. And so one of the things you have to do as an author when you're writing a memoir is you have to share enough things that it's interesting for people, but not so much that you've kind of crossed that boundary of you know, what's sacred and private and what, you know, you shouldn't just be telling everybody. So we got to Sudan and lived in Sudan in a refugee camp called Msagata. I still remember we had a little hut there, and the thing that really helped us is we had 5 goats, and we had some chickens, and we milked the goats. I still remember milking my goat. I had a really dark goat. We milked the goats, and we, you know, the chickens, man, they'll keep popping out those eggs. They'll keep you alive. They will keep you alive. Like, chickens are good. Chickens are your friends, you know? So the chickens and the goats definitely saved us. Like, having that in the refugee camp. The United Nations was also there, able to provide rations as well. And really, the turning point in my life was, well, there are lots of different turning points, but probably the key turning point, I would say, up to this point, was when my family applied to be sponsored to come to the United States of America. And we were selected as one of the families to come to the United States. So I went from living in a small hut made of straw and mud to living on a busy highway outside of Chicago. And that's one of those things where my family didn't deserve it more than another family. I certainly don't deserve it more than another kid to have that opportunity. But my family did have that opportunity. So we start our new life coming to the States. I mean, when you think about immigrants that come to the States, one of the questions you have to ask is, okay, what were the people's experiences like before they came? If you're living in London, you know, and you already are used to a big city, and you already have a degree and all this stuff, your experience is going to be very different than a third world immigrant like myself or my family, where you aren't used to big cities, you have no idea how a first world country really operates or what that economic system looks like. And I'm not trying to, and by the way, we have big cities in Ethiopia. I just wasn't from one of them. I was from, Addis Ababa is a big city in Ethiopia. Someone who comes from there would be better adjusted to come here than myself. But I lived, stepping back, no problem. No problem. Thanks. Thank you for being here, by the way. And we're happy to have you here. So we came to the States. I'm curious, what do y'all think the best thing about coming to the States was? This is kind of interesting. I always love asking this question. Just shout it out. Don't be shy. TV. Bathrooms. Electricity. Running water. Shopping. Food. One of the students this morning said women. I was like, we have women in Ethiopia. I don't have to worry about that, okay? I started telling them. We have beautiful women in Ethiopia. I don't have to worry about that. So it's always interesting to see what people say when you ask them that question. Go ahead.
The freedom to be whatever you want to be.
The freedom to be whatever you want to be. It's hard to argue with that, right?
McDonald's.
Oof. Yeah, McDonald's. You know, I think it's hard to... I think if I had to pick one thing, I think if you ask anybody who's ever come from a situation where they were a refugee and they fled their homeland due to war, they will usually tell you it's peace. Just having access to peace, to stability, to some semblance of order. And I still remember every night before we went to bed, from 1983 when we came to 1991, my family prayed every night for Ethiopia and Eritrea, and we just asked God to end the war, because that's my grandma that could be dying today. That's my uncles. That's my mom's sisters. Just think about the people that are the closest to you, that you care the most about. Imagine if their lives were at risk every single day and they could die because they were in a war-torn situation, and not just one or two people, but everybody. And so that was one of the happiest days of my family's life, actually. We had such a huge celebration when the war ended. And, unfortunately, our country started fighting again later on. But that was awesome when the war ended. And there's just so much optimism and happiness, at least within my family. Now, obviously, when we came to the States, there were a lot of challenges. Some of the biggest challenges, we didn't know any English. My father knew what I call negative English. And anybody who's a third world immigrant knows what I'm talking about, okay? It's when you know just enough English to get yourself in trouble, but not enough to get yourself out of trouble. So you think you know what's going on, and really you're just digging a hole deeper. So that was an experience going on with my father, who thought he knew what was going on, but had no clue. And so then we'd be lost, and there's a lot of crazy stories. I remember when my mom first got her license. This is even after 3 years. Like, she was always scared to go on the highway to Chicago. Except one time, she accidentally got on the highway. And so she got on the highway, and she's freaking out, going crazy. You can get interpreters to help you pass a test, so just because you got the license doesn't mean that you can even read all the signs and stuff like that. So she had no idea what was going on, didn't know. And so she pulled over. My father was screaming. She pulled over. You know, everyone thought they were going to die. So my father was like, all right, I'm going to solve this. So he got out of the highway, and he walked down for, like, all the way out the exit and stuff. And he came back with the police, and the police blocked up the exit so nobody could come in. And my mom drove out the exit and came out to her safe side streets. But you won't talk to a third world immigrant who can't tell you at least 10 stories like that. Because that's what it means to adjust. You are going to run into things that go wrong. You don't have the full, you don't know the language fully, so you're going to get stuck sometimes. I still remember, we were talking about embarrassment a little bit. I still remember I would go to grocery stores with my parents, and it was really just a crazy experience anyway, because
you go to 8 stores because, you know, tomatoes would be off by 10 cents here. Then, like, you know, you got to get some onions that are off by, you spend like $50 in gas trying to do it, right? But you're going from like 8 to 4 o'clock buying like 6 things, right? And I still remember being in the stores and my father would, you know, his eyes didn't work too well. So he was always nervous that he was going to get lost. So you'd be in a big store like a Walmart, right? And let's say he didn't see you. Y'all know my full name is Salamawi. What he would do is, all of a sudden in the middle of the store, he'd say, Salamawi! He just screamed that out to everybody in the store. And inevitably, one of your classmates is there, right? And, like, right there, and they're like, you know, who's that crazy person? You're like, I don't know, right? Like I do not know. And so that's part of the experience, though, of being a third world immigrant in this country. And I look back at those stories now and can laugh, but trust me, when you're going through it, I still remember when my parents would come to parent-teacher conferences. Oh, man. If you had one thing that was off, you know, like on, you know, if the teacher said you were disorganized, then if you spilled a cup, it was like, oh, look at you being disorganized again. Or like, if you like came home late, it was like, oh, look at you being disorganized again. Or like, if you, you know, if you beat your brother up, it's like, oh, look at you being disorganized, whatever. So there's just a lot of interesting moments in the house. But the thing that my parents were able to give me, even though they didn't give us a lot of money. There were 6 of us. We lived on less than $1,000 a month from first grade to 12th grade. My mother and father didn't really speak the language too well. And if you're wondering what happened with my father and his job, it's not like my father could just come to the States, walk into the Cook County Hospital in Chicago, you know, open the doors wide up and say, listen up, everybody, call the head doctor. Call the person in charge of hiring people. The master is here. You should have seen me back home in Eritrea and Ethiopia. Boy, I was legendary. People in this country don't care what you were doing in the backwoods of a third world country. They could care less. They want to know what you're going to do right now for me and what your education is, where you got trained. And you got a sense of it in my book, but I can tell you one of the saddest things I ever experienced in my life was seeing my father just slowly unmanned. Like we're just from feeling like he was part of a community where he mattered and where he could do something, to feeling like, man, nobody here recognized any of my strengths. I can't even care for my family very well. I can't, all the other parents can drive. I can't drive. Whatever it was that a parent normally does, he wasn't able to do it in this country. That was one of my favorite things about going back home to Ethiopia, to be honest with you, was when I was in the States, I always had to show my mom around. You know, I always showed my mom everything. But that was her chance for her to show me everything. And that's usually the relationship between a parent and a kid, is the parent's the one who's showing the kid. Well, if you're an immigrant kid from a third world country, for the most part, you're filling out all the forms. You're filling out the welfare forms. You're filling out all the stuff. You're filling everything out because you know English better. You're doing all that. And that was really special for my mom to have that opportunity to go into that role that I know she always wanted to be able to play more, but she was never allowed to because she just didn't have the resources. So the one thing though that, well, there are a lot of things my parents gave me, but the one thing that was really important, and to show you, maybe I can have, 2 volunteers, and here's who I need. Let's get a woman who's played on a basketball team at some point in her life. This is going to be kind of random. Anybody? You play on a basketball team at some point in your life? Right there? You have? Come on up. We need your help. Come on up. Don't be shy. Give her a round of applause. So I told you I'd do activities, right? You're going to see now my first activity. Come on up. Come on up. And what's your name?
Yuka.
Yuka? Everybody say hello, Yuka. Okay, now I need one more person, and this time I want the absolute worst basketball player in here. If you're a scrub, this is your chance to shine. If you are just the worst basketball player, you never could make a shot to save your life. You're the biggest. This is your chance to be a part of what's going on. All right, come on down. All right, come on down. This is good. thank you for having the courage to come down and say this, okay? what was your name?
Alan.
Alan, everybody say hello, Alan. All right, so actually what we're going to do is, believe it or not, we're going to do a little experiment here. Have a little basketball rim right here. We'll put it up here. Everybody see this? All right, good. Now, maybe we can have both of you step right here. We're just going to do a simple experiment. We're going to take a shot and see who gets closer. That's all we're going to do. So, sit down. Alan is going to go first. Come on, and take your best shot, Alan. Give him some love. You got to give him a lot of respect for coming up here and saying that, you know, not being afraid. Maybe shoot it from even here. That's cool. Just come over here and shoot it from here. Shoot it from right here. We're going to have you both shoot from the same spot. Shoot right.
It's not going to matter.
It's okay. Do your thing. Yeah.
Okay, here we go.
Do your best.
All right.
Not bad. Not bad. So, came. I don't know if you saw it, but it came like that. Came over the rim a little bit. Now, it's going to be Yuka's turn. And for this part, I just need everybody to help me out with something. For this to work, we need you to be completely silent for this next part. And then you're going to get the point of this activity. So, here's what we're going to do. So one of the things that my father, when we first came to the States, I still remember this, he sat us down and he said, yeah, nice job. He sat the kids down, we're 7 years old, I'm getting almost expelled from school at this time because I'm getting in fights all the time. And he sat us down and he said, This is advice on how to make it in America, what we had to do, especially when it came to education. Here's what he said. He said, there's these things called scholarships. Get one. Okay? And that was it. It's 12 years. I want to see a scholarship. Okay? At the end of the day, that's what I want to see. And so my goal was set for me. All the time. If I had a D or a C, first of all, I got, and again, any immigrants in this room might know what I'm talking about. I was going to get whooped 2 or 3 times a week no matter what. Okay? But that was just normal. In my house, you could be an angel, you're still getting whooped twice a week. I mean, that's just how, and we're not talking about American whoopings, by the way. Okay? I don't know if y'all, we're talking about some crazy. Now, if you show up with a C, show up with a D, you're going to get it, man. You're going to get it so bad because that's not part of the plan, man. That's not the goal. You have a goal. You got to knock it out. You got to set your sights on it, and you got to knock it out. And when it really kicked in for me was, because as you read in my book, there were obviously a lot of times where I did a lot of stupid things as a youth. Where it really kicked in for me and where this concept became especially important was starting as a freshman. It actually started as a process, as a spiritual process, where through my place of worship, they had us journal a little bit about what kind of person we wanted to be, and they'd have us evaluate ourselves each day to see if we were becoming that kind of person. So I said, hey, let me just try that for my whole life. So what I did was, at the beginning of each quarter or semester in high school, starting my freshman year, every quarter at the beginning, I would write down each class I was taking and the exact grade I wanted to see on my report card. And then every day, I wrote other stuff down, other goals down, but every single day I'd write how I had done on reaching that goal. And that consistent, daily, just aiming for that goal, I'd miss a lot of times. I'd fail a lot of times. But that trying again and again and again and journaling until I had about 10 journals, that was absolutely the most important thing I did by far. There's no way I'm ever, asking someone to get a scholarship, that's easy to say, but to actually do something like that, you have to have that kind of discipline, especially if you don't have the other resources. You have to have that crazy discipline where every single day you're looking at your goal, you're thinking about it, and actually what I would do is I would calculate my average weekly in each class. I would know exactly what grade I was getting in each class, and it was a very methodical process. It wasn't like I just showed up and I was like, oh, here, you know what, I'm going to college now. It was starting from, especially ninth grade, just like I said, every single semester, writing those goals down. I did the same thing at Harvard, and the times I did the worst at Harvard were when I didn't do that, when I just showed up at a semester and I was like, all right, whatever happens, happens. We'll see what happens. And then whatever happened did happen. You know, and that's what happened. But so one of the lessons is, and I would even say this to the adult literacy students here. I know firsthand the challenges that folks who are adults face when they're trying to improve their literacy skills. Because my mom faced the same challenges for a long time. I saw that all the time. It's much easier when you're a kid because that's your job, to go to school. When you're an adult, you get sick, your kid gets sick, something happens with work, you get interrupted for 3, 4, 5, 6 years at a time. Then you have to go back and relearn stuff and forget stuff. That's one of my mom's goals has always been to get her GED. You know, she's still years away from doing that because, you know, she would start going to school and then something would happen with our family where my dad would get sick or I'd get sick. So who's the person who's going to stop? My mom. She's going to solve that. And 2 years later, she tries to go back to school. She forgot. You see what I'm trying to say? And that's a big challenge. But what I want you to get from this activity is never ever say, I don't have enough resources. I don't have enough talent. I don't have the thing. Even if you do have a few resources and a lot of things working against you, the best thing to do is just to say, whatever I have, I'm going to aim for it and put my whole heart into it. And that's how people's dreams come true. That's one of the things in working with youth that I get so upset about is that a lot of times what we teach our youth about accomplishing dreams is, hey, who's got a dream in this room? And everybody will raise their hand. And just by raising their hand, people feel like their dream's going to come true. It's not going to come true because you raise your hand. It's not going to come true because you said you had a dream. It's only going to come true if you have a disciplined regimen where you knock it out day after day after day for years. If it's a dream worth having, the only way it will come true is if you're that methodical about it and you really focus on it and push it and put those hours in for years, then something great can happen. But the message to a lot of our youth is, you can have whatever you want in 1 second for very little effort, and you know, I'll show you how to do it now. And that's absolutely the wrong message. It's a horrible message. It's the opposite of how the world actually works, as every adult in here knows. That's not how it works. And so that was something that my parents gave to me, which I thank them for. That even though they were refugees, even though they were on welfare, even though we didn't have a lot of resources, they never said, "Hey, well, that means you can't be successful." And that was something that was really important for me to hear and always have at the forefront of my mind. Now, I'm going to speak. You know what I'm going to do now is I can keep speaking for a long time about a lot of different things. What I'd like to do now is maybe spend a minute just to wrap up the story a little bit and then just allow you to ask whatever questions you want about whatever I've said. If you want me to talk about my book of Beatles and Angels, I will. If you want to hear about some of the stuff I'm doing now, I will. If you want to, just whatever questions you might have about my journey, about anything, you can ask anything you want. Views on anything going on in America, I'm happy to share my views. And wrapping it up, though, I still remember vividly going to the mailbox when I was a senior in high school in our low-income housing and opening it up. And seeing that fat envelope from Harvard, I knew what that meant. They don't. If it's a fat envelope, that means you got accepted. If it's a thin envelope, because they tell you all the stuff you have to do. If it's a, as follow-up steps. If it's a thin envelope, that means you got rejected. That's pretty much how that stuff works. And so I saw thick envelopes, and when I was walking back to share the news with my mother and father, and they had never even heard of Harvard. They hadn't. I filled out again when you're a third world immigrant. And you're the kid, that's just another form you fill out. If your parents didn't help you fill out the welfare form, are they going to help you apply to college? Are they going to help you fill out that college application and write your essay? For the most part, no. I'm not saying that all third world immigrants are on welfare or anything like that either. I'm just saying that was my experience. And I still remember going and talking to my parents, though. And the thing that was the sweetest about it was because a lot of times in life, what I shared with you before, you're trying to get across the border and you see an evil side to life, you see something that's really nasty that makes you question life. And then so when you see something where hard work paid off or a dream came true, that makes that kind of stuff mean so much more. I was able to share that with my mom and dad and say, you know what, Mama, you were cleaning bathrooms on your knees till your knees were busted these last 6 years, but I got some good news for you. And that was an awesome moment for me. Some of the things I'm doing now is I speak with a lot of youth, and youth get very interested in my story, but I'm always pushing back at them and say, well, how are you going to create your own story? It's not enough to read a book like A Beatles and Angels and say, hey, that guy had a good story. The whole point is you need to create your own story. Everybody in this room has a story. And all our stories are equally important. And all of us can take steps to make our stories inspiring stories. And when you read an inspiring book or you hear an inspiring speaker, the message should never be, oh, that person was inspiring, or that was an inspiring book. The message should be, hey, what are the steps I take to create my own inspiring story? What are some of the things that I do and in my own way? And so that's my passion now in working with youth, is working on that kind of stuff. So let's open up the floor. It's almost I think we have 5 minutes till 8 o'clock. Is that right? And so let's take some questions. I had wanted to do two more activities with you. Did y'all like the one activity? Was that good? It wasn't bad, right? I pride myself on my activities. That's the thing I most take pride in. But I have some good ones. Maybe we'll have to get together again and you can see some of the other ones I have. But who's got questions? Why don't you just hand the mics to people who have questions? I hate picking people. I want to answer everybody's questions.
Hi. Just wanted to ask you a question about your book. We have a class here from Rosemont College, and we just wanted to know, how hard was it for you to write the book? What was your audience, and how did you know when you were writing, when you went deep enough into a memory or a topic?
Okay, so the question was, you know, when I was writing the book, you know, just what was the process? How did I know if I was, you know, going deep enough or not deep enough, or just what was that process like? That's what you're asking, right? And okay, so the audience, this is tricky. First of all, that's an excellent question. You always have to, a speech, a book, we think it's about ourselves, but it's not. It's about the audience that's going to be receiving it. Like when we're asked to speak somewhere, a lot of times we fret so much about, well, what am I going to say? Not realizing that it's all about the audience and not about you. And same thing with the book. I'll answer your question on depth first. Actually, I'll do the audience question. See, there's different audiences. One audience, for example, is Eritreans Ethiopians. They're going to read that book. As the only Eritrean Ethiopian who has written a memoir as a refugee, I felt a huge responsibility to tell that story well and to be very fair and balanced in telling it. So, for example, I had different Eritreans and Ethiopians read the book, and they would say things like, why did you call that group rebel soldiers? They're liberation armies. You know, and so I'd have to change that or think about how I phrase that. But if you want to see the most carefully written part of my book, it might be, I try to limit it, but it might be like that page and a half where I actually describe Ethiopian Eritrean history. Every word had to be considered very carefully because given the tensions and what had happened between the countries, you can't just go around saying whatever random thing. So that was an important audience. Plus for me, never having had a book, where I saw a name like Selamawi or Tuwalda or Mehret in a book, I was hoping to add something to people from my homeland. And that's been one of the most gratifying things for me is when immigrant kids or kids from different countries, even if it's not from my own, when they say, hey, you know what, I could really relate to your book because my parents did the same thing, or you know this, or they were like, or I experienced that same thing when I went to school, or that meant a lot to me because I didn't have that. At the same time, my audience was also all of you in this room, not all of you, but a lot of you in this room who are interested in learning about different cultures. Don't necessarily want to read an 800-page book to do it. You want it to be story-based, but you don't want a deep dive into, you know, you don't want 100 pages of Ethiopian history in there. You want just enough to be acquainted with it and to understand it at a decent level. These are some of the decisions I had to make in writing it. And then in terms of how deep you're going into the book, like I shared with you before, you have to ask yourself, what are you willing to share? What are you not willing to share? And then also for me, it was pretty painful when I had to relive my brother passing away, my father passing away, when I had to go interview my mom and hear about some of the things that she didn't like about life but that she wanted to share with me. There were times I was writing a book when I was crying. There were other times when I remembered some really funny things, and I was laughing. I mean, when you write a memoir, it's a very personal experience. It's not like you're writing a, you know, a dispassionate analysis of, you know, the fall of Constantinople or something, you know, in 600 years ago or something. You're writing about your life, and that introduces a lot of elements that might not ordinarily be there. Did that answer your question? All right, thanks. We going here next? Thanks.
Hi. In the book, when you mentioned several times that your father would tell you and your brother, I will make you lost.
Yeah.
What did that mean in America?
So my father, when you say, I will make you lost, katfaka. There's a couple of folks in here who know what that means. That's why I said it out loud for them. You know what my father would do is we lived near about half mile away. There were these huge woods. My father would take us there at midnight when we were like 8, blindfold us, spin us around and leave us there. We had to find our way home, and that was like the scariest. I'm just joking. Okay. you know how in the U.S. there's some things that you say that aren't true. Like you tell your kid, "You're gonna be dead meat. You're not really gonna kill your kid, but it's as close to killing them as you can come to. If you could do more, you would, but you can't. That's what it means. When you're getting mad, you know you better just back off, let them cool off. You know, you push them too far. It's a lot of the things I translated, like when I said, you son of a woman, that's like a literal translation in my language. Like there's words that say, you son of a woman. You know, it's again, for those who speak Tigrinyan here, it's wed de sebeti. You know what I mean? It's considered like to be, that's what that means. Wed de sebeti means son of a woman.
Kadfaka means I will make you lost. So that's the kind of stuff where if you speak the language, you're gonna be able to pick up on little things like that and really appreciate it, because you're like, hey, he did a little translation. He could have said, you're going to be dead meat, but instead he did this little play on words kind of stuff. So I enjoy doing a lot of little things like that. Sure, I think we got some more questions here and there. Yep.
What are you doing now? I don't mean this minute. What are you doing now?
Oh, yeah.
With your life, and also, how did you go about getting an editor, and do you plan to write any more books?
Okay.
Three questions.
Questions were, what am I doing now? How do I get an editor? Am I planning on publishing more books? So right now what I do is I have a company called Mental Karate, and it does what we talked about before, where I basically show youth how to harness some of their inner, I believe we have inner powers like initiative, discipline, contribution, all these things that are extremely powerful. And if any youth harnesses those powers, they can create some great results. So Mental Karate provides a structured way of helping youth develop those. And so I do that with schools around the country. So that's what I put most of my time into is because the focus can't be on my story. For this to be my career, it can't be me going around the country telling everybody about my story or writing books about me. That's really limited. I'm sure you'd agree with that. That to go just share. But if the focus is on everybody else's story, then it's unlimited. Then you can really, because you're impacting other people then, and you're not telling your story again and again and again. In fact, you're helping other people write a better story. That's much more interesting to me. And, you know, I worked for a bank. I had an offer to work with a consulting firm. I tried those places. I didn't like those. I didn't want to work at a bank. I didn't want to work at a consulting firm. I realized that once I did that was not my joy. It wasn't what I was passionate about. So came back to working with youth, because I always felt excited when I was working with youth. And when I think about the opportunities that I've had, I'm like, why shouldn't other youth have those opportunities? Why shouldn't other youth of any background develop themselves? So that's kind of how I think about it. In terms of publishing the book, so one of the things that happens when you go, so one of the cool things about going to Harvard is you meet some really strange people. Like, so one of the kids I met, if you went into his dorm room, you know what he had up on his walls? He had written a book when he was 18, and he had the first 300 pages already up on his wall. He didn't have any posters, he had those pages up all around his room. He only had like 15 to go. And this guy, what he did was, I saw before my own eyes how this guy self-published his book. Then he sold, he was a marketing machine like you wouldn't believe. He sold 65,000 copies of his book. And then he sold the rights to Simon & Schuster. Actually, he did really well. It was a seven-figure deal. He was 23. That's pretty good, right? So that's what he did, right? So he was one of my friends. I talked to him a lot about writing. He was like, hey, you know what? You should consider self-publishing. So I did. Self-published. Coached me on it a little bit. Did lots of speeches. Sold books out of my car. And in a deal nowhere near as generous, okay? Let me emphasize that, all right? But still not a bad deal. Still not a bad deal. Then I sold the rights to my book to Little Brown & Company. Either, because if you can prove that there's a market for your book and you've sold X thousand copies, and you can show that to a publisher. In some ways, that's easier than trying to compete with the 50 million people all sending. Like, I go into my editor's office in New York, and there's just manuscripts everywhere. And not only that, she's also responsible for helping promote the books that were written last time, and she's got to manage an assistant and all this. It's very hard to get in there unless you have an agent, and so. That was my path. In terms of writing more books, I'm almost done with a huge fan of fantasy books growing up. Loved them hugely. And I just, very close, I wrote the first two drafts of book one of my fantasy trilogy. So it's one of my goals with it is it's actually, who watched Lord of the Rings here? Were there any black people in Lord of the Rings? There are none, right? You didn't find one black person in Lord of the Rings, right?
There will be some minorities in my fantasy books. I guarantee you that, okay? And they're going to be heroes. They're going to be doing stuff. But it's going to be multi-ethnic, reflecting the America we live in, but set in the medieval times. And actually, the plot behind it is this. It's this world. So it's called the... The series title is The Five Harmonies. And it's set in this world where there used to be these five universal principles. Things like courage, that kind of thing, that gave people unbelievable amounts of power. You could press a button and be in Japan. But over time, this world has lost all those has lost the five harmonies. They only have two harmonies. And this 13-year-old boy and his friend who's a midget have to bring back the third, fourth, and fifth harmonies. And they bring back one harmony in each book. And so it's about all the forces that rise up to oppose them once they decide to kind of bring these things back. You know, all couched within an adventure story with swords and all that kind of stuff. So the first book's called The Third Harmony. It'll probably come out in like a year, but I'm psyched about it. I'm really excited. You have to be kind of a fantasy adventure story kind of person to appreciate it fully, but hopefully it'll be in your library soon. Let's take another question. We have, go ahead.
Did you write the book first and then approach your family, or did you approach them first and then start to write?
That was actually very challenging, that process. I approached my family first, and I had them, and I told them, you will have final veto power on anything, because I care about my family way more than any book I write, or any, like, that's, you know, I came to this country, I didn't have money, only thing I came with really was my family, and it wasn't a big family, so that made us really close. This issue came up again, because actually when I was in, I was at a book fair in Philadelphia, and guess who was sitting right next to me, who had the booth right next to me? Spike Lee. Alright, so I was sitting right here, so I was hanging with Spike Lee for like 2 hours, and I signed a copy of Beatles and Angels for him and his wife, and we were having a good time, and he gave me his address to send a script version of my book of Beatles and Angels to. And so my friend and I worked on it for 5 years. We wrote like 8 drafts, and we just sent it to him recently, but the same issue comes up even more with movies, because the book, I get to control everything. The script, you hand it off to these folks, and script writer is like, doesn't matter. You know what I mean? Once the director and all those folks get their hands on it, they do whatever they need to do. Actors do it. And so you're putting your family at a lot more risk when you do something like that. And I still, although they would never grant me that right, I would still probably only do something like that if I could have some sort of veto power. For the reason I shared with you before, I care way more about my family than any movie. Like that could come out. That you couldn't make enough movies to let me allow you to portray my mom in a negative way, or the memory of my older brother in a negative way. Like, I'm not gonna let that happen. So, great question. Any other questions? Do we ask any folks that haven't had a chance to ask? Get the mics.
Has a Harvard student, what are your thoughts on American history? I'm thinking about Du Bois. It just popped in there.
About Du Bois? Okay, so great question. What are my thoughts on American history? You know, when I was at Harvard, there was a professor there named Cornel West. And Cornel West was in love with Du Bois. I mean, he taught a whole class called The Thought of W.E.B. Du Bois. You know, if I had to share with you the three most impactful books in my life, probably that have shaped my thinking the most, one would be a book about my personal faith. Another book would be Seven Habits of Highly Effective People, because I just didn't know as a child, like, how to organize myself well. I didn't know how to, all this stuff. And that book really, really helped me become more effective. And then the other book that really had an impact on me was A People's History of the United States, because by Howard Zinn. Because, you know, history, you know what the golden rule of history is, right? Yep, those who have the gold write the history, right? That's a golden rule of history. And so when you're talking about people like Dubois and you're talking about people who are going to look at alternative, who are going to look at American history from, you know, alternative perspectives. You know, they're going to ask, well, what did it feel like to be a Native American and have everyone, you know, you knew basically slaughtered or put in camp? What is it going to be like? What did it feel like to, you know, go from Civil War, things are going pretty well. You know, we just got all our rights to, oh, we're stuck in a sharecropping system where it's pretty much like slavery, you know, all over again for another X number of years. You know, so, I mean, that's what the cool part about being a history major in college is. In my opinion, in high school, you have to memorize facts. You focus on, oh, what happened in 1812? What happened? When you're in college, the level you should be thinking at is, you know, if I had to write this history, how would I write it? Or why did they write this history the way they wrote it? It's you take it more from the point of view of the writer. Like, the facts are important, but you're not going to be an award-winning, you're not going to get any prizes for knowing that, you know, who the 13th president of the U.S. was. You will get an amazing prize for showing how, you know, his thoughts and philosophies resulted in XYZ thing that people hadn't thought about or something like that. So that was the coolest part, I would say. So my thoughts on American history are that, to sum it up, I would say there's a lot, I think everybody here would agree, there's a lot of good and there's a lot of bad. Like, there's a lot of really great things about this country that have happened on this continent. There's also been a lot of nasty things. We don't often, the average high school student, if you look at the textbooks, they often don't share what those things are. I mean, even if you look at something like Manifest Destiny, this is taught in textbooks. I remember reading about it when I was in ninth grade, and it was just seemed okay because I was in ninth grade and the government gave me this book, so it's cool. But really, what does Manifest Destiny tell you? The United States basically told the rest of the world in like 1805, Latin America is ours, don't mess with it, like, it's ours, we own it. And that was like how we ran that. I mean, if you think about it, and that was like, and because God gave it to us. And that was the driving force of, for the next 150 years, you know, even till now in some ways. And so, but if you're a high school student, you're just reading that stuff, you're like, oh, that's cool. You know what I mean? Like, of course God gave it to us, you know, like, we're the greatest country in the world, right? That's what you're thinking, right? But that, hopefully people's thinking is pushed as they get older. And by the way, I'm not trying to say the U.S. is all bad, da-da-da, because look what happened in my homeland. Look at some of the repression that's going on right now, where, you know, people are jailed in lots of different ways. You know, I'm not even trying to pick a fight or anything like that, or say this or this is happening in Ethiopia, but, you know, or in Eritrea, but there's lots of things you can't say or do in Eritrea and Ethiopia right now that you can do in the United States of America. There's certain opportunities that you have. We all have public education. My mother didn't have a chance to go to school. Here, you have to go to school, or you're in big trouble. So I think what happens usually is people are usually on the extremes. They either think American history is all bad and evil, and aren't we a horrible empire, da da da, you know, like, or they're like, well, we've been perfect, you know, ever since the Declaration of Independence, right? That kind of thing. And the truth is probably, in my opinion, somewhere in the middle. You know, it's just like, and you have to. I think a sophisticated view of it would recognize that there's been good and bad, and also, I'll leave it at that. So with that, I think, thanks for the question. It's an interesting question. I think, unfortunately, might have to wrap it up now. I've gotten a signal, I'm supposed to finish at 8. But I want to thank all of you. I want to thank all of you for being here tonight. Coming out to listen to me, I appreciate that. I'll be happy to stay and sign books for anyone who has books. I also have, if you're interested in any of the stuff I was talking about with mental karate, I have some information on that as well. And if you just want to shake my hand and say hello, do that as well. Whatever you want to do. But I just want to thank you and thank the library once again for putting this together. Thank you very much. I appreciate it. Thank you. Thank you, Mary.
Thank you for listening to a podcast from the Free Library's Author Event Series. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, Information is available at freelibrary.org.